Welcome.
Hello.
Another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our ongoing exploration of the cultures of consciousness. So August is here, and I realized that the third birthday of Expanding Mind kind of came and went. It was in early July in 09. So it's been a pretty fun ride. It seemed to have went by pretty quickly, actually. And I would not have thought it would have been as easy as it's been to get a really amazing stream of very diverse and interesting guests without too much trouble, and frankly without having to deal with too much marketing people, and really trying to just get people through friends and mutual contacts and the internet, and try not to go through publicists and do too much of that sort of routine, because I'm really devoted to keeping a kind of conversational freshness and a kind of spontaneity going on the show. I'm not the most self-promoting person out there. There are some people I've met in life who are what I call organically self-promoting, which means that it comes natural to them. It's part of their joie de vivre, and one envies these people, particularly in these days when almost every statement or move one makes in the world could be interpreted, or is interpreted by many people, as a possible site of self-promotion. But one does things in the world, they go out in the world, and they're kind of like, you know, they're your children, or they're things that have come through you, and they deserve some promotion, even if I don't particularly deserve promotion. So if you like the show, like what we're doing, it's always good to get that sense, either by letting us know, letting PRN know, letting folks know, tweeting, rating on iTunes, blah, 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 all that good stuff. You know, people ask you to do it all the time, but I don't get paid, and I do this because I love it, and I want to offer something to weird people like me, people who surf the boundaries between science and mysticism and personal experience and you know, skeptical views, and really trying to map out a space that I think isn't really treated very well, at least at the kind of depth and playfulness we try to do here. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of give a little shout out to Expanding Mind and all the folks who have been able to keep it going, and to encourage you to let other folks know about the show. Switching now gears to the topic at hand, Philip K. Dick, who comes up again and again on the show, as you know, listeners know, is once again kind of rising in the mindscape with the Total Recall remake just appearing as we speak, basically. A lesser known film, or lesser discussed film, though a much more exciting one, is The Treatment of Radio Free Albemuth, which some advance word has it is the most faithful Phil Dick adaptation yet, more than A Scanner Darkly, which is usually seen as the closest fit to date. And also, we have in San Francisco, for you lucky Bay Areans out there, the Philip K. Dick conference is coming up towards the end of September. And in light of all this, I thought I'd bring on my good friend and fellow Dickhead, David Gill, who is the organizer of this conference slash festival. Kind of somewhere in between. It actually is officially called the Philip K. Dick Festival, for those of you who are already hunting down the information online. So we will be plunging into Dickiana in a moment. But first, bring on our co-host to Expanding Mind, Maja Dau. Maja, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
That's good. Does it feel like we've been doing this for 3 years?
Man, it's just been so much fun. It, like you said, I feel like it's gone by pretty fast as well. To me, I always really look forward to Thursdays and getting to chat it up on here. So it totally doesn't seem like it's dragged or been forever. I feel like it was just the other day we were sitting on the phone talking about doing it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, and there's always that, you know, there's a whole kind of hamster wheel effect to, you know, the internet in terms of producing stuff, and you start a blog and you have like, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to post every 3 days, and then, you know, it can become quite a chore. And then sometimes you can tell that even in the way things are just kind of cranked out, and people feel like they have this obligation to just produce more media, blah, blah, blah. But what I like about this experiment is that it wants, you know, I don't have to push on it very much. It sort of draws me forward. You know, I'm interested in the conversations. It becomes really clear who's the right person to ask for the show. And it's just been sort of a very organic process, and really happy that you made a big deal of it. But anyway, enough of this self-congratulatory weirdness. Let's bring on David Gill to Expanding Mind. Hey, David.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Pretty good, man. How's it going?
Oh, pretty good.
So let's start out with, like, why did you think it was time to have a Philip K. Dick festival, to actually draw people together?
Ah, well, it's long past time. You know, I've been meaning to do this for a really long time, and, you know, Dick's been on his ascendancy for years now, and every year I would say, you know, this is the year to do this. A couple of years ago, Lord Running Clam, who is a major player in the fan world of fandom, put together the first Philip K. Dick Festival in Needham, Colorado. There was very few of us there, as you can attest, Eric. But it was a great time, and so I really wanted to update that festival. I wanted to bring it to the Bay Area, where Dick lived a substantial portion of his life, and bring it, and then have it be a bigger event. You know, we just couldn't make it to the middle of nowhere in Colorado, and so this is you know, centrally located, and it should be time. Well, and there's been so much great scholarly work. Just in the last couple of years, Umberto Rossi published his Twisted Worlds book that examines Dick's ontological instability. And Lawrence Rickles' I Think I Am Philip K. Dick came out, and we're still trying to figure that thing out. So, it's time.
Well, one of the interesting things about, you know, when I first described it just today, I said a Philip K. Dick conference, because in some ways it has the shape or intention of an academic conference, where you have people who are, you know, many of them professional scholars, some independent scholars who are working on the material, come together, give papers. It's going to take place, you know, on a university campus here in San Francisco. But at the same time, there's this strong fan element, which you're, as tapped into as you are the scholarly stuff. And so even the name of it, it's actually Philip K. Dick Festival, because it really is trying to bring the fans and scholars together, and that doesn't happen that much. I mean, it does happen in certain fields, large, you know, sci-fi, fantasy conventions. You're going to have some room where academics are talking about, you know, their close readings of novels, and you know, people in, you know, Batman costumes who are walking around or whatever. So it does happen, but there seems, to my mind, there's something special about the connection of Phil Dick fans and Phil Dick sort of scholars, because of course the scholars are really fans too in a lot of ways. But more than that is that there's something special about Phil Dick fanhood, particularly when you go start stretching back in the day. And it's been this kind of weird underground that has a real sort of heady philosophical character, but also one that's really invested in, like, cultural history. I mean, it's a very intelligent fandom.
It is.
That it isn't goofy and fun and obsessive and nerdy and all that other wonderful stuff. But there's something special about it. And it seems to me that your conference is like part of the whole, the festival is part of the idea, is to kind of like bring this stuff together and kind of revitalize the conversation as more and more new fans come in who haven't really tapped into that old school vibe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my whole kind of approach to this is to understand that, you know, first and foremost, the scholars that are working on Dick are fans. You know, they wouldn't be. It's not like a great career move to devote your academic study to, you know, a guy who's, you know, in academia still considered mostly a genre hack. So these people have all kind of gathered together. And the interesting thing is, the fans for Phil Dictum are so prodigious. You know, they're making books and they're compiling lists of stories and they're making lists of all the music that's ever been in his novels. And they're like actively really working with the material in a scholarly way, in a way that involves close reading and analyzing. And so, there's been this kind of parallel track. Where these scholars have been doing this stuff and these fans have been doing these things. And like you're saying, I just want to bring it together so that we can all sort of benefit. The scholars can get something from the enthusiasm of the fans, and I think the fans can get something from the framework that the scholars can bring to the study of Dick, you know, to put him in a larger context and examine him in contrast to what's going on today.
Yeah, and I think there's something about the that, you know, otaku quality. You know, there's that great publication.
Yeah.
The sort of obsessive nerddom. The word comes from Japan, but there's something about Dick's work that it really calls for that kind of meticulous, obsessive sort of collection of little bits of information and trying to weave it into a larger pattern that, of course, ends up going out of control. And so all you can really do is sort of create these different pictures of it because it's so multidimensional. And, you know, it reminds me a little bit of Thomas Pynchon's scholarship, particularly on Gravity's Rainbow. You know, but it's a little different because in some ways Pynchon's not that different a character. You know, he clearly spent a lot of time in California,
yeah.
Most of his time in California. You know, he was familiar with the drug culture, with a certain kind of absurdist humor, also very, you know, deeply informed by modern literature, playing with paranoia, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of similarities, but for a variety of reasons, Pynchon, you know, was like literature with a capital L.
Yeah.
And, you know, after Gravity's Rainbow, there was a sort of a whole world that emerged of scholars, English majors, writing papers, blah, 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 and people went so deep into, like, those tiny, weird little connections that are buried, the allusion.
Yeah.
You know, all this kind of, like, arcana, like Kabbalah or something like that.
Yeah.
And Dick has that same quality, but it's been done, as you say, more in the fan world, in a lot of ways, with some kind of scholarship. So there's something really fun about being a Phil Dick fan over and beyond just how cool the books are.
Well, we don't know, for instance, how autobiographical Pynchon's work is. You know, it doesn't on its surface appear to be nearly as autobiographical as Dick's. And so one of the things that's interesting is, like, you start to realize, oh, there's like an author hidden in all of these works. Like, if I read all of Phil Dick's works and I read Sutton's biography, a view of this guy starts to emerge, and then you start to really value the insights that you can gain into the Phil Dick, the guy, or I mean the insights that you think you can gain into Phil Dick. And so all of these little bits of information become so important to track down because they might be, you know, one more piece of insight into this mysterious guy that you just for some reason want to decode.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that really drives these types of books. Like, I think, you know, Lord of the Rings is another one that inspires that kind of archivism and puzzle solving within people. And that's one of the things that Dick did, is it becomes kind of like the never-ending story, because as you're decoding some of these things, what I've found and what I've talked to some other people that find is it'll link up with stuff that's happening in your life. So he was like some kind of crazy wizard, where I think what makes people so fervently obsessed about this stuff is that while they're finding out these weird little linkages within the Philip K. Dick material, some crazy thing will happen in their life that syncs up to it. And I think when that kind of thing happens, it gets, like, meta, you know.
Well, one example of that, I mean, is the way that my whole experience of clutter and dust is totally, it's permanently rewired by this Phil Dickian mode, both the idea of Kipple as a kind of principle in the universe that's constantly creating more clutter, but also just a general sense of the pervasive presence and the kind of depressing presence of entropy. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, you know, one of the weirdest things about, you know, the relationship between mood and the perception of reality, you know, we all know it because most of us live in the same place we have lived for months or years. And some days you get up and you're like, wow, it's my place, my cup, it's my nice comfy chair. You know, and you feel like at home and things are crisp and well-defined. And you can wake up in a bad mood, and it's like, oh, the floor's peeling back, mm-hmm. and I got to repaint that thing, and it's like the lever's falling off, and you become aware of, like, this pervasive force that's kind of eating away your ability to sustain that kind of that pleasant reality of home. And for me now, that experience is just totally Bill Dickey, and it's like I'm in the novel now, and it happens all the time.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's all over.
But I wanted to pick up on something else that you mentioned about the difference with Pynchon is that, you know, even though Phil Dick wrote these crazy stories that with outlandish scenarios and science fiction elements turned upside down and blah blah blah, is that the more you know about him and the deeper you read, you know, you realize that he is writing himself and his story and his experience into his novels in a very particular kind of way, because they're not overtly autobiographical, obviously, but they're so animated with his own concerns, his experiences, his perception of place, and his own turmoil. I mean, you can see that they're, you know, that these stock figures that keep coming back that have almost an archetypal feel, like, you know, whatever, the cruel bitch woman, which is a problematic one. I mean, sometimes quite misogynist. But you see this kind of figure come back, and you're like, man, this guy's trying to work something out. And so as you go deeper in it, you actually become more kind of intimate with him, and that's where you get the real fandom, is that you feel like in some way you're communicating with him, or you're understanding his plight, and somehow his tragedy as well as his creative brilliance is part of the, I don't want to say appeal, but part of the draw, because it's almost like you're kind of witnessing somebody working through this really, you know, heavy stuff. Because I suspect hopefully most of his readers are probably not suffering quite the degree of psychological stress that he spent a lot of time doing. And that, I think, is also part of that attraction, that kind of personal.
Let's take the idea of this, the sort of problematic female characters. You know, if you read a lot of Dick's work, you understand that character, you see it. But then if you read late enough into his work, if you read his last novel, Transmigration of Timothy Archer, it's written in the first person from a female protagonist who's unparalleled in Dick's work. It's a major accomplishment. So then you start to get this extra thrill of, wow, this guy pulled it off. He did it. You know, all the odds were stacked against him. People said he'd never amount to this, or that he'd always write this genre hack, and here he did it. So you start, you for whatever reason, he's like a great underdog to root for, and so you can get kind of swept up in the pretty miraculous things he managed to accomplish in spite of the things he had stacked against him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been thinking about, you know, you and I were just at a conference a couple of weeks ago, giving papers, you know, an academic conference, giving papers on Dick, and one of the things that came up was, you know, someone was responding to the exegesis. So you and I both worked on this enormous bear of a book, and
yeah, it's a tough one.
You know, and the guy made a very, very good point, which is he just sit there and goes, "Look, I read through this.
Yeah.
There's brilliant stuff in it. There's incredible passages of incredible writing. It's very poignant at parts, very incisive." But overall, this guy had the impression that, he boiled it down, he was basically just kind of crazy, and it was sad.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking about it, and I've really been wrestling with that, like, this almost point, like, it's not just that he was, you know, English majors will think, or, you know, English scholars will think that he's just a hack writer, but it's also that he's kind of crazy. And then the way I was going with it, no, it's not, it's much more complicated than that, because he's actually healing himself through the work in a lot of ways, and that by kind of understanding him and getting to know what he's doing and how these healings, if you will, do kind of happen in the text, even though it's a very dark world most of the time, that it's not just like, oh, here's this guy who's just crazy and cranks out this crazy stuff. And again, the transmigration of Timothy Archer is the same thing. It's that he's reflecting on the same ideas that at night he scribbles in his exegesis, these crazy, paranoid, sometimes horribly repetitive, claustrophobic, mad guy on the corner kinds of scenarios. I mean, some of it's much better than that, but some of it's like that. But then he's also writing this novel, which is not only a well-realized sort of masterwork of contemporary fiction or modern fiction, but he's really critiquing his own madness. I mean, he's got this character in it who's pursuing these crazy ideas and is driving himself off the edge and hurting people in his life. And you see that he's aware that there's more to him than just this crazy guy who stays up late at night writing things, which is, you know, still pretty crazy. So
yeah.
It's a very rich, multidimensional problem, like how he interacts with his own work.
Well, it's, you know, I mean, the problem of mental illness is really, I mean, Dick worked a long time to kind of explore the idea of mental illness. If mental illness is just a different way of seeing the world, or maybe a different world being seen, or, you know, who knows. But the thing that I get is that mental illness tends to gravitate towards more mental illness. In other words, the problem of mental illness is its inability to let you get better. And so the fact that Dick is striving, you know, in his writing and I think in his life and what he's doing to improve his condition, to get through the stuff he's got to work through, is really pretty inspiring, and it belies this idea that at the end of the day he's just a crazy person. Because crazy people are stuck, and as destructive and cyclical as Dick's behavior was, it kind of spiraled in a direction towards positivity. You know, and at the end of his life, he was a saner person than he was at other points in his life. The fact that he struggled with it so visibly on the page is inspiring.
Well, I got a
personal question for you, just because I know a little bit about your background. You know, I want to ask you, like, what was it about Dick's work that you got into, and what really responded to it? But for me, I suspect that a lot of people have it because in some way there's a brokenness or a challenge in your own life, maybe early on, that you encountered that somehow, even though his worlds were dark and often didn't have any clear resolution, that somehow they spoke to, you know, the things you were wrestling with in your own life in a way that a lot of other things don't. And I'm curious whether something like that was true for you.
Not particularly. You know, I had a roommate give me Scanner Darkly when I was 18. And what appealed to me about it, you know, was just the fact that it had sex and drugs in it, and it was a science fiction book, you know, like that just ticked all the boxes for me. And so I did that thing that I think so many Dick readers do, where I read probably 30 of his books in the next 2 weeks, you know, maybe 3 weeks, and they all kind of blended together. And you know, I just sort of lived in that world. I just enjoyed reading the books. I felt like I was talking to somebody who was really smart and really sensitive and was telling me a pretty good story. So I immediately latched on to that, but it wasn't until I got to the University of Hawaii and was studying journalism at the time. I was buying books for an American literature class that I was in, and I look over in the books for the next section over, they're teaching Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? So I immediately, you know, put my books for this section back, go register for this other section of the class, and it was taught by this guy, Bob Onapa, a science fiction writer in his own regard. What he did was he tied Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep into this, you know, mainline artery of American literature that starts with Eliot's Wasteland and goes through The Great Gatsby, and really is, again, the idea in the course was that this book was enunciating the same points, and it really resonated with that. You know, this idea that in a world that's full of entropy and decay, what propels us forward is kindness and compassion and connection. To me, that really resonated because as a kind of 18, 19 year old boy, man, I hadn't been taught that. Like, I wasn't able to express my feelings, and because of that, all of my relationships in my life were completely stunted and, you know, messed up. And so it was really the getting me past this, you know, existential angst of early 20s, like, oh my God, nothing means anything. What do I do with my life? What matters? What means anything anymore? You know, Dick was there to say what matters is to care. What matters is to connect. What matters is to know the people around you and to invest yourself in them. And so that really brought me forward. But luckily, I didn't really have to struggle with very much in order to get over that.
Well, and it's true, and that's part of, like, the spiral of evolution that I think happens with the Dick material, you know? Like,
yeah.
You were saying, like, it's not that he keeps trying to get to positivism no matter how deep and dark into the caves he goes spelunking. And like you said, like, something that's insane is when someone repeats the same thing over and over expecting a different result.
Yeah.
It's almost like he loops out trying to find the way out. It's like he's going around in a circle inside the cave trying to find the spot
where's the weakest point in this roof, and if I start digging through, I'll get to light. Yeah.
So it's more like methodical than insane, because he has a goal, right?
Yeah.
That he's trying to get into. And to me, a lot of that really reminds me of, I don't see the difference between that and, like, Carl Jung's Red Book, right? Where Jung then descends into his madness on purpose, and, you know, the result of it then is not only to heal himself, but, like, as a result, then he heals other people.
Yeah.
Which is where the empathy comes in. And I think that's, like, where that real magic of Dick's empathy comes in, is that through his writing this, people that have maybe mental things, like a teenage boy or whatever, his writing empathetically touches them and helps them heal themselves, too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the story of Dick being a kind of agoraphobe, antisocial high school kid who really lived in fear of people, you know, a lot of science fiction readers can relate to that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real common sort of condition. And so he's kind of putting some salve on a lot of people's wounds as he goes.
Well, yeah, and I'm also kind of just, you know, thinking about this whole question of empathy, which, you know, in his nonfiction writing, he raises a lot. I mean, it's really, if you're going to say a one-liner, like, what did he, you know, what did, you know, what form did compassion or spirituality really take, or religion take in his life? It was this call for empathy, for the kind of connection that has. And it's a funny term. It's a funny word. It's like, we don't use it that often.
Yeah.
And it's almost like we're not really sure, like, is it like sympathy? Is it like compassion? Is it like love? And it's also something that a lot of people don't talk about. You know, a lot of people who think that Phil Dick is like this great postmodernist and, you know, post-human, and he's depicting the world of just, you know, when androids are taking over and we can't figure out where reality is because everything's mediated, blah, 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 blah. Yes, that's an element of what's going on, but also this emphasis on empathy and the yearning for it, you know,
yeah,
that really animates these things. So I'm just curious, after all this time and thinking about it, how do you approach that question of, you know, specifically empathy? Why is it empathy, and what does he mean by that? What do you mean by that?
Well, so part of the problem that philosophers and spiritual people and people who think struggle with is, you know, who am I? What am I? Why am I here? What's my purpose? And that sort of egocentric thinking bears no real fruit, because you can't ever put your finger on what that I is. And so the idea that you could, instead of trying to figure out what I am, say, what do I need to do? What is this person? What do they want? What are they thinking? There's something a little bit counterintuitive about that like, it's almost like spying, like, what are they thinking? What are they, you know, it's a little bit paranoid. But it's deeper than that, because it's putting aside our sort of primacy, like, we're important to ourselves because we are us. Let's set that aside for a moment and think about this other person. I mean, it's you know, the typical thing is, let's use it in an idea of suffering. Let's understand that this person here is suffering. But let's update this. You know, how many of us as liberal Democrats can put our minds in, or our heads into the minds of a conservative Republican, you know, can really understand how their beliefs are grounded in their minds? The thing that's making the world so Dickian is that now these political beliefs, these ideological niches that we inhabit, are mutually exclusive. We're not even in the same worlds anymore, you know. So can you put yourself in the mind of somebody from this other world, and can you imagine what they're thinking and feeling? If you can't, then what is that? Then we really are in this sort of mode of primacy where we're locked in ourselves and we can't get anywhere, you know. So it seems like the reason for this, because it stretches outwards rather than inwards. That the real fear that Dick seems to convey in his fiction is the fear of isolation, of withdrawing into ourselves and being stuck there, you know. So his solution is, don't withdraw, connect, get out of that, get out of yourself, you know, and invest yourself in other people. It's much healthier.
Wonderful. There's a lot of good questions raised. We're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dow. We're talking with David Gill, organizer of the forthcoming Philip K. Dick Festival, and blogger at Total Dickhead. And we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dow. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking with David Gill. We're talking about Dick and loving it. before the break, you were talking a little bit about empathy, and this, I think, is really an important thing, especially in all literature, because I think if reading a novel is successful, it invokes empathy, because you're able to transfer your consciousness into another's head, literally just through the act of reading the book.
Empathy in literature, good.
That's the magic of reading. It expands your consciousness by putting your head into the head of the author or whatever they're doing. And I think a lot of people, like Eric said, what's the difference? And that you, I feel like, articulated so well. Sympathy is something a lot of us think we know. Like, sympathy is when you feel something someone else has felt because you've felt it. Like, you've been through it. Like, someone has cancer. You're like, oh, I had that cancer. I went through it. I know it. I know that deal. Or, like, you get your heart broke by someone cheating on you. You're like, yeah, I know that song, you know.
Yeah.
But empathy is when you feel something someone else feels without ever having experienced it yourself.
It's the empathic imagination.
Yes,
it's called, right? And little kids can't do that. It's a real milestone in their development when they can imagine, they can feel for something that they haven't actually gone through, but they're imagining what it's like.
Right, and then it breaks like this kind of barrier, and I think that it's, some authors do it, and they aren't really thinking about doing it. It just happens as a result of, you know, their work. But when an author starts to consciously do it, I think it kind of starts to take on these other proportions. And I think when you say, like, that was kind of a big MO for Dick, it's like he starts consciously transferring people's consciousness.
Yeah, he's like, he's beaming them up or beaming them out or something. Yeah,
totally. I mean, I think a testament to the success of that is how crazy people get about it, and, you know, how deep people get into it. And I was wondering, this is something I wanted to ask you, if through your experience with all this material and getting into it, if a result not only in your own studies of it, have you found that you can kind of enter people's heads at all? Like, has that happened to you? Have you had any, like, transference of your consciousness?
I have not. I'm a pretty centered guy. My experiences don't lend themselves to the paranormal particularly often. But in general, like, can I read people's, do I get a sense of who they are from kind of looking at them or whatever?
Right.
Who knows? but you do get a, you do get a sense that there are other people in the room.
Right.
You know, and that's that was tough. Like, I was really self-centered as a kid. I don't think that's unusual. But it's hard to get out of, and it's really important to move beyond. So yeah, I think Dick's work definitely helped me with that. But there's a lot of literature that has sort of the same message. Like I just mentioned, The Wasteland and The Great Gatsby. I think both of those texts, you know, say the same thing, that life sucks and the world is problematic and there's no real solution other than, you know, the way that we adjust ourselves to living. And so maybe one other thing that's interesting about empathy, and especially if you think about it in terms of the context of the last century, is it sort of reinforces the primary notion of relativism, you know, that we're all seeing things from our own perspective and that perspective colors what we see. Like that to me is sort of the big lesson of the 20th century. You know, maybe Dick is just taking that just a little bit further.
Hmm.
So, what are you most excited about in terms of what's coming up with at the conference in terms of
the festival? Let's see. Well, I'm really excited to get to have a chance to have Fancy Radio Free Album Youth, which is an independent film John Allen Simon has produced based on Dick's later work. Which I really like. I've seen it a couple of times, and I'm really excited for some hardcore fans to get to see it because it's really the first time we've gotten a look at a Dick adaptation without the studio lens, which tends towards big budgets and famous actors who aren't particularly good. So I'm excited about that. Lawrence Rickles is coming over from Germany. He wrote a very difficult book to understand about Phil Dick. So I'm really hoping that he's going to shed some light on his work. But the main thing, and this goes back to not only the festival that we went to in Colorado, but before that, dickheads are just wonderful people. I've yet to meet a dickhead, if that makes any sense. These people are really nice, and like, you know, invariably, you know, you start talking about Dick, but you know, you talk a little bit about your own lives too. And so when we came out of Colorado, I felt like I'd really made some friends. So I'm really looking forward to expanding that friendship circle. And when you just get people sitting around talking about Dick, good things happen.
Yeah, that's it. So what about that film? Is it like Radio Free Albemuth? Did they manage to do it sort of? They funded it themselves, or
it's shot using I forget what it's called. It was shot in less than a month using a sort of state of the art digital system that they could lease for relatively inexpensively, and it has, you know, the only main star in it that we've heard of is Alanis Morissette, who plays this sort of dark haired girl. The rest of the cast is, you know, people who I see now and then and things here and there, but are not big actors. And John Allen Simon's just a serious fan who really wanted to test, I think, how this stuff goes onto the screen. And he just succeeded, to my mind. One of the things that's so different about it, I mean, just to give you a sense, we were talking about how Dick's worlds are always run down and messed up, and in the movies that the so far that we've seen, that's not like Minority Report. That's not the case. In Blade Runner, it is, of course, and that's what makes that so good and so true to Dick's vision. You know, but it tends to be these like new shining worlds with shiny robots and fancy cars, and so that's just totally antithetical to the Dick that I know. And so it's nice to see, you know, just normal cars driving around, nothing fancy on a road that you might recognize. It brings the story into the here and now in a way that I think makes it more relevant.
Well, that's great. That's great news. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Obviously, the films, you know, I mean, I often wonder about people who find out about his work through the movies.
Right.
And then they're like, well, okay, but actually most of them are kind of bad.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, well, no, there's this one. You got to check it out. You know, so you know, it's really nice that both of these kind of movies are in the mindscape right now, and people are, you know, I just talked to a reporter from Hollywood.com yesterday about.
Oh, I did too.
Total Recall. So we talked about it, but then of course we both mentioned this other film, and maybe it gets out there and things like that. But that begs a larger question, which is, you know, and I'm sure she asked you this, and I, you know, there's a lot of ways of approaching it, but just what exactly happened such that he became so well known, so popular, so not just in Hollywood, but you know, as a kind of literary figure, and it, you know, he's really sort of become, in a way, arguably the most important American science fiction writer, at least for people who are not just totally into SF.
Yeah.
And so what is it? It's not that, I know we talked a little bit about it, it's not that he's like a great prophet of like, he didn't like imagine the internet exactly or anything. So what is it?
Oh, I think it starts with Blade Runner. I think that you know, that movie really demonstrated science fiction's ability to be high art. Maybe 2001's there a little bit sooner, but it's a pretty serious movie. In not only in it's visually stunning, but I mean, you know, people are still writing about that, and people are still using, you know, the androids in there as interesting philosophical ideas and stand-ins and so forth. So you have that, and I think, you know, immediately Hollywood recognized, hey, there's whatever, 50 more novels like that. And I think they got to work. And what's interesting is the way that the Dick's content is gradually sort of eroded from the movies, almost to the point, it's like Dickian, so you have this Phil Dick film that has no Dickian elements other than his name on it.
Yeah.
You know, that's Dickian, like that evaporation of content through capitalism is incredibly Dickian.
True.
So do you think that the sort of fandom or the sense of, you know, not just, oh, he's an interesting writer, you got to know about him like a lot of other writers, but that there's something kind of whatever, extra nourishing, fascinating, esoteric, worthy of deep contemplation, that sort of enthusiasm sense, do you think that's going to, is your sense that it's growing?
That's an interesting question. My sense was that it was growing. Up to, like, starting maybe with the Library of America release that Leatham choreographed, we were getting articles about Dick in The New Yorker and Time Magazine, and that, to me, there were 3 or 4 months there where the tingle in the air was just, it was palpable. And I kind of feel like perhaps we may have, for the time being, reached the high water mark with the Exegesis publication. I think, you know, that was something that had to happen. It was important. But I think the tide's going out a little bit now. I think the scene is, you know, looking out there. Are there anybody else out here we need to be checking out on? Because Phil Dick's kind of been done. And I frankly don't blame that, you know, if you read, it's the same article gets published, you know, 50 times, where it just, you know, sort of lists the litany of bummers that Dick had to go through, you know, and then he was great because he invented, he imagined robots in the future. It's like that, you know, to have mainstream consciousness sort of manhandle Phil Dick's ideas, that was nice for a few months, but it'll be nice when he maybe submerges a little bit again.
Well, it was an interesting experience, and I'm really interested to hear your reflections on this as well, watching the Exegesis come out, because, you know, it was hard to tell what it would look like, how it would play, you know, and you have this example of the Red Book, which, of course, is nice because, you know, Jung, unlike Phil Dick, is a high modernist kind of, you know, intellectual figure in people's imagination, so the idea of his crazy book is kind of like, you know, a little bit more tantalizing, and plus it has all these really great pictures. I mean,
yeah, it's beautiful.
It's good doodles, but they weren't quite the same thing as, you know, this object of the Red Book is really quite a, you know, a remarkable thing, and they did a really good, you know, job, and they could, you know, really put this, you know, lavish kind of production. It was like, wow, it's kind of similar. Maybe, who knows what's going to happen, but, you know, the reviews, which there have been, you know, very few reviews,
yeah,
that I've come across, and they're all the same, which is they gave it to some science fiction writer, and like most science fiction writers, the person is secular, which is fine,
yeah,
but it just means that most people who are, you know, not interested in religion, they have a tin ear for religion. It's like, you know, the way that some people can't really read poetry. It's like,
yeah,
people can't, they just don't get it. They don't, yeah, it doesn't seem interesting. It seems silly or just meaningless. Whereas if you have an ear for that stuff, it doesn't mean you believe it, but you just have like a taste for it. It's very rich. But they give it to these science fiction writers, and they're like, "Well, he's basically crazy. Just read the novels."
Yeah,
you know. And it was, I, you know, it was disappointing. I mean, it,
yeah,
I'm sure that cool things are happening out there, and I guess that's maybe one of my questions, since you have been in any way historically keeping up with a lot of what other people are doing. I'm curious, just in terms of the fan worlds you follow or the writers you follow or whatever, whether is the exegesis just going to sink into obscurity, or is it going to percolate, and what do you think?
It'll be around. I think, you know, the great thing about it for scholars is, I mean, for literary scholars, is how Dick goes through his own work and analyzes it from a number of different perspectives. That's almost unheard of in the literary world. You know, like I have a Herman Melville, you know, maybe Moby Dick was about my unconscious desire for my mom. I mean, that would be wild. And
yeah.
And the scholars would have a field day with that. So there's a lot there just on in that regard. But, you know, I absolutely agree with you. I think the secular media is just absolutely misunderstanding everything about it. I've yet to even read the word Neoplatonism mm-hmm. in a single review, you know. And I think if I were reviewing that, I would point out that it's, among other things, it struggles to reconcile early Christianity and Neoplatonism.
Yeah,
you know, that's something that it does. That's something that's a problem that Dick works through on the pages there. And, you know, if you're not versed in those particular issues and you're not interested in them, it just goes right over your head. But the problem is to suggest, well, it's just endless theorizing with no goal and no attributable arc of thought. You know, that's just BS, because we know that there's actually some pretty standard Christian theologian stuff going on there.
To me, that's why having conferences is a good idea, because then you can get people with some of the insight and experiences, and then people that know other stuff. But
yeah.
The problem is, with the sci-fi stuff, there's such a division between religion and science that getting any of these religious people to read sci-fi books is like almost impossible sometimes,
right.
You know? So,
yeah.
I mean, for me, that's something that I discovered. Like, for me, and I'm sure with Eric, too, you've probably found this, and maybe that's why we're such dickheads, is we love religion and science.
Yeah,
and
right?
I look
There's nothing
at all
wrong with
of
either
that.
One. They're both fascinating.
Yeah, and then I read Philip K. Dick. I'm like, oh, my God, he's touching all these things in such good ways, and nobody does this, and
yeah.
He's bringing this in there and that. But I think the reason people don't notice that is because traditional Dickey scholars, you know, are science-y people, and
yeah.
They don't have any kind of religious mystic experience, and Dick is a mystic above all else.
Yeah.
And so I think that, like, if you leave that aspect out of it, it's like you said, you're missing this huge chunk of the whole thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, it's really interesting the way that people choose to view Dick. You know, I don't think that very many people choose to remember that he was a rabid anti-abortion pro-lifer.
Yeah.
You know, and wrote stories about it, which are really problematic from a feminist perspective, you know. And so a lot of times it just becomes easier to just kind of, well, let's not think, you know, that's just a rough edge we can sand out in our memories, you know. We can just not have to think about that. So I think there's a lot of that. There's a lot of people that just think, oh, yeah, you know, Dick was a science fiction writer who believed in science and the supremacy of the rational mind, and that's pretty antithetical to Dick. You know, I think a lot of his... He's sort of an anti-rationalist in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, the ultimate example of that is just the way in which one would just have to say that in some ways, in many ways, he was a Christian.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If asked, most of the time or a lot of the time, it's hard to say because he would say different things, but it's clear that, you know, from the moment that he started going to the Episcopal Church in 1963, that even though he wasn't a regular churchgoer, he would declare himself not just a Christian, but specifically an Episcopalian.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Christ meant something to him.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And that the idea, you know, that's just ridiculous in our day and age. Christ, oh, come on. You know, get over it. That's just an imaginary friend you've created for yourself, you know, and they're not even going to bother to think about it as an image or a symbol or what, you know, and anything. So it's funny how the mind, you know, the human mind remembers how it wants to, you know.
No, and I think that for me, that's one of the most interesting things now, even specifically the way in which he is a Christian, and Christ is an important figure, and there are Christian themes in his,
yeah.
in both his experience and in the work, but they're twisted and they're problematizes it. You know, in our world, most of the world that I think that we live in, people who are like really believing Christians don't often interact with people who are like really interested in, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and weird esotericism, and da 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 da, and all this stuff. And there are some really interesting places. And I think that, you know, if there's been like these layers of the reading of Phil Dick's work, you know, the first major one is in the 70s, and it's mostly, you know, people who are influenced by Marxism, and they appreciate his novels because of they show how commodification and how capitalism, you know, rewrites reality, and they stand up to those kinds of readings. There is a tremendous amount in that kind of historical materialist view. But from that perspective, all this religious stuff was just totally kooky. And then there was sort of a second wave, you know, Umberto Rossi talks about this, where it's like he's the great post-humanist of android consciousness and cyborg future and the destruction of the human and you know, the loss of self and the myriad networks of technology, blah, blah, blah. Again, lot there to explore. And I think that it's not that we're at a phase where we're seeing him as a religious person, although he is, in some ways is a religious person, but it's more that I think there's like that his ethical and moral concerns and his religious imagination are as important as any of that stuff. And it gives us a different kind of picture, whether that picture is going to go on to be this sort of, you know, pop celebrity that he sort of became briefly, I kind of doubt. But in terms of creating a another perspective and in some ways a more personal perspective on him, I think that's one of the ways we seem to be going.
Well, one thing that would be great is if Phil Dick could influence a notion of religion or religious. You know, it's like to be religious doesn't involve going to Chick-fil-A, you know, once a year and buying a sandwich to make a political statement. You know, it involves trying to reconcile deeply contradictory and problematic notions and find some sort of grace amongst it. You know, it's like a very difficult soul-searching process that in America is just, you know, it's just devolved to, well, you get a couple drops of water on your head and you're set, you know. So it would be interesting if we could move the idea of what a religious person is more in the direction of Phil Dick, where they're not some dogmatic machine that's bought into some system, but rather are deeply engaged in the process of trying to figure out ontological, you know, questions of why we're here and what our meaning is and how to get value out of the time that we have here and so forth.
Well, and that's participation, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the super irony thing is that Jesus is like the epitome of empathy, right? Because he suffers all the sufferings. Everybody's suffering. He takes it all into his flesh in one moment at that second that he dies. So he's like the supreme empathist. And, I mean, that could be part of Dick's relationship to Christ, is that, you know, empathy that's involved in it. But ironically, most people say, oh, well, Jesus did all that, so I don't have to do it at all.
Yeah,
in fact, they
yeah.
use it as a way to escape participating in it, when the whole point was, no, like, this is how you do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, very good point. I mean, that's the sort of irony of Christianity, though. You know, it's so weird that you take your little soul up to heaven, and there you and your soul, you know, party with Jimi Hendrix or whatever, you know, and Eastern religions, that whole notion of I just evaporates, you know, and you join the cosmos. And there's something very American about our compartmentalization of our soul and how imperishable it is and how it's uniquely ours.
Well, we've got to wrap up here pretty shortly, but I just wanted to say, you know, another way in which Dick is a figure for a kind of religiosity, something we talk a lot about on the show, was that he was very much a comparativist. He was very much working in a field where all the world's traditions are somehow present in some way, and that he, you know, also owed a lot to Taoism and to Hindu Vedanta, and towards certainly at the time of a divine invasion to Jewish, you know, ideas of the Torah and you know, Kabbalism. So he's also trying to do that kind of what some people look down on as a kind of smorgasbord, you know, cafeteria religion where you pick and choose whatever you want, that kind of New Age cartoon. But it goes much, much, much deeper than that. And that's one of the things you see him doing in some of the novels, but certainly in the exegesis, is he's trying to figure out a way through this sort of multiple world of multiple views.
Yeah, he wants a grand unifying theory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just want to let folks know you can go online to the Philip K. Dick Festival website and find out more information about that if you can make it. And you can also follow David's work at totaldickhead.blogspot.com. So, David, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks, guys. It was fun.
Great.
Take care.
From me and Maj and all you out there, keep your minds open.